I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and let's start today with the aftermath of earlier headlines. Baghdad is reeling from at least five attacks that killed more than 120 and wounded more than 400 earlier today. The attacks included at least three exploding vehicles, and they came ahead of the March elections. Ernesto Lodano is Baghdad bureau chief for The Washington Post in Baghdad. Ernesto, is anyone taking responsibility?
We haven't heard a claim of responsibility yet. The government has blamed a Sunni insurgent group, Al-Qaeda, in Iraq. And this is the group that took responsibility for similar high-profile bombings back in August and October. So it's a pretty safe guess to say that this group is behind this latest wave of attacks.
And what did they target, and what does that tell us?
A lot of the sites targeted today weren't as high-profile as the buildings that were targeted back in the summer. However, there were more bombings, whereas in August and October you saw a couple of bombings each day, and in both cases, massive bombings. This time around, we saw a spate of at least five explosions scattered throughout the capital. They went after government facilities, in some cases education facilities. There was a prominent university, a judicial college where judges go for training, and an academy of fine arts, also a courthouse. So these were certainly locations that are high profile and that are important, but weren't the key ministries that we saw targeted in the past. I think what this tells you is some of the prime targets in the city, in the wake of the recent attacks, that have become pretty hard to access once more. You have secure perimeters around them. You have a lot more sort of blast wall layers preventing just regular traffic from getting close to those ministries. So it looks like insurgents are going after softer targets, but that are still relatively high profile.
Well, softer targets, that means more civilians, places of learning. What are Iraqis saying to you about what that means to them?
Iraqis that I spoke to today, I went to three of the bomb sites. People expressed a lot of anger toward the government, even more so than the insurgents. In this capital, I think Iraqis have become used to dealing with a great deal of carnage. There's growing outrage about why the security forces are unable to stop this. After each of these attacks, you see government officials go on TV and say they've arrested the people responsible for this. They've broken apart the cells, and yet they happen again. And I think there is sort of growing impatience among Iraqis about whether or not their government is truly capable of stopping this, and whether this is a government that can protect them, that can keep them safe.
In your view, is any government? You have to wonder how these huge amounts of explosives are getting through checkpoints in downtown Baghdad, which are all over the place. But on the other hand, is it possible to prevent it?
That's a good question. The city certainly remains bunkered. The central part of the city and most of its neighborhoods are still ringed with walls of concrete. What we see is that every time there's a big bombing, you will see the checkpoints really get very tough and serious for about a week or two, if people are sort of on high alert, and then the standards kind of loosen up a little bit.
Why aren't Iraqis angrier at the bombers?
My guess is that they understand the motivation behind the bombings. They know that the bombers are likely insurgents who want to undermine and cripple the government. The group behind the bombing is a Sunni group. Al-Qaeda in Iraq is made up of Sunnis, and possibly an alliance of members of Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party. That's an accusation that U.S. and Iraqi officials have made. So I think ordinary Iraqis understand what this group is about and what its motivation is. And it's something that they've learned to live with. I think the reason their growing sense of anger is directed toward the government is this is the government that has, in recent months, told them that it's a capable government, that it's in charge, that it's ready to assume responsibility for security as the Americans withdraw. It's a government that has been, in the eyes of many Iraqis, a little cocky. So I think that is why we're starting to see this bubbling anger.
Ernesto Londono, The Washington Post Baghdad bureau chief, speaking to us after today's bombings. Ernesto, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, a recent article in the Los Angeles Times has hit home for the wide network of Americans who've adopted children from China. The report found that many of the children who were presented as orphans may have been kidnapped or seized. Since the early 1990s, 80,000 Chinese children have been adopted by parents from other countries, the majority in the U.S. Because under China's population control policies, families in much of the country are allowed one child, and culturally many prefer boys. So tens of thousands of mostly girl babies were abandoned and adopted by grateful Americans. Well, now the LA Times reports that in rural areas in Hunan province and the southern province of Guangzhou, these children may have been taken from parents who now mourn them. 7 years ago, Sybil Gardner adopted an 8-month-old baby named Zoe from Guangcheng in Jiangxi province. She traveled with about 24 other parents and used a popular and reputable agency, U.S. Asian Affairs. Sybil joins us first from California. Sybil, what did they tell you in China about Zoe?
The story on Zoe was that she had been abandoned and found at one day old on the steps of the salt works of this little town, Guangcheng, by a man whose name we wrote down, and that he brought her to this, the equivalent of an orphanage. And Zoe was put in the care of a woman, her foster mom, who then had to bring her back to the orphanage 2 weeks before we arrived. And at that point, the orphanage director took pictures of Zoe with this foster mom, and so I have photographs of her with that woman and that woman's name. So I do have some clues that I can use if I decide to go back there in the next year or so to try to find the story while these people are still alive.
So here you had at least what you thought was the official story of Zoe, and then you read the Los Angeles Times expose about child trafficking. What were your thoughts when you read that?
Well, I was horrified. My first thought was how horrible for a family in China to have somebody take a baby from them.
No.
And then my second thought was that the story that I've been telling Zoe since she started asking questions, what if that was completely not true? How would that mess up my kids' psychology? Mm. And then the third thought was, well, I know the chances are very tiny, but what if she was one of those tiny number of babies who were stolen? Now what?
And now what? I mean, are you going to be one of those parents that have been saying they feel they need to go back and find out for sure?
Well, I think I am one of those parents. What do you do? What is the moral imperative here? And I think that I do need to do some research, but one of the things that I also need to do is talk to a lawyer to just know what the scenario would be if the worst case were true.
Well, then the worst case would be that there is another parent in China missing their child. What would you do if you find that out?
I think you have to be there in that moment and try to find out how to have a win-win situation out of a tragedy. But you also have to understand that it's a very different culture, and those people are in kind of a catch-22 because it's illegal to have more than one child, and it's illegal to abandon a child. So finding out the truth is not going to be very easy because no one's going to say, oh, yes, I abandoned my baby.
We know that adoptive parents with children from China have formed a lot of organizations. Have you talked to other parents?
I have. The group that we went to China with, we get together fairly often. And some of them just don't want to talk about it. And some of them don't believe it. I talked to one parent who thinks that the chances are really minuscule and that it's going to be up to the children to investigate when they get older. So there's a real diversity of opinion here.
Well, we know that you've said that if you do go back, you might want to go back with other parents. You've said you do have a clue, the pictures of the foster mother. But even that, you know, are you even questioning if that's true?
Actually, I believe that that is true. There are pictures of the other foster mothers with the other babies, and we have their names. Plus, they also post something called finding papers. When the baby is 6 months old, they post these descriptions of the baby with the baby's picture in the local paper. And if nobody comes forward, then that baby is available for adoption. I have Zoe's finding papers.
Well, Sybil Gardner, if you do find that there is a birth mother who may have had Zoe taken from her, where do you go from there?
I wouldn't want to be in denial about it, but what the solution to that dilemma is, I don't know. You know, it's what would that person want? What would Zoe want? What would I want?
And one of the considerations might be that at least they know each other.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm not threatened as a mother by my child knowing that there is a birth mother out there. She knows that she has two mommies and two daddies. And that's a really hard concept for a 7-year-old to grasp. But I don't want to hide things from her, although this story has been very upsetting. I've declined to do some television interviews because I would not want one of Zoe's friends to see it and ask her if she was stolen from her mom. So I don't think she's ready to be presented with that possibility.
That's Sybil Gardner, who adopted Zoe from China. Sybil, thanks so much for talking to us.
You're welcome, Robin.
Well, let's turn now to Martha Groves, who's written about all of this for the Los Angeles Times. Martha, child trafficking, how widespread is this?
I would say there have been several hundred instances that have come out in the Chinese press and then to some extent in the U.S. press and the European press. And people that I've talked about this with say that if hundreds are known, then quite possibly many more children are being trafficked.
And why is this happening? Some people are blaming the adoption fee, $3,000 adoptive parents pay orphanages for a child. Is that a factor here?
Right. I think that's one factor, but a big other factor is the fact that family planning officials are abducting children. Many of my sources tell me that they're doing this not necessarily for remuneration, but to maintain their jobs. Their job is to keep over-quota children out of their villages. And by over-quota, I mean it's not a strict one-child-per-family policy. In some of the rural areas, families are easily allowed to have more than one child. If the first child is a girl, because there is a strong need for a boy in a farming family, and the boy then goes on to marry, and his wife comes into the family to take care of his parents.
Yeah, we're reminded China is a country without Social Security, so sons are considered Social Security.
Exactly. Now, to some extent, and this is a tangent, daughters have been found to be extremely valuable to the parents of late as they go to the cities to make more money in factories and such. They tend to send that money home, whereas young men tend not to these days. So in a way, the tables have turned a little bit and families have really come to value their daughters.
So you say some families are valuing daughters more, but also that some family planning officials are abducting children to try to maintain the family quotas in their villages and keep their own jobs. A lot to digest. Let's take a break. We'll have more with reporter Martha Groves of the LA Times, who, by the way, is also an adoptive mother. We'll ask her about that. Later today, are Iranians in the U.S. being tracked by their government on Facebook? That's later, but we'll be back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. If you've just joined us, we're talking about a recent report in the Los Angeles Times that drew attention to a number of cases of child trafficking in some rural parts of China, which has adoptive parents like Sybil Gardner asking questions. We just heard from Sybil. She's considering traveling back to China to research her adopted daughter's past. She said she's also going to consult a lawyer. Some of her friends have reacted to these new reports with anger or denial, and Martha Groves has been following their reactions for the Los Angeles Times. Martha broke the story, but also has a child adopted from China. She joins us. Martha, we know there's been a big problem in the past with abandoned girls because of China's one-child policy and the high value placed on having a son. But you say that that may be changing. Girls who are sent to work in cities are more likely to send money home than boys. So we're wondering, is that part of what could be causing this child trafficking? Are there fewer abandoned girls to sell for adoption?
I don't know that we can ever know that, but I do know that the Chinese government has slowed way down on the adoptions. It's now taking qualified couples 3 to 5 years to adopt. And in the past, it was closer to a year. I would say this reflects to some extent China's interest in toning down any criticism of its program. They're trying to get rid of this trafficking. You know, some of these people who have been found to have trafficked have been sentenced to long prison sentences. I've read in the Chinese press that a couple were even sentenced to death. So they are trying to send a strong message.
Right. Well, and Martha Groves, looking forward, what is your sense of what might happen? Sybil Gardner and other parents are talking, and you brought this story to our attention, the idea that parents are considering going back to China to try to find their children's provenance, you know?
Right.
What's your sense of what's going to happen?
Well, to the extent that Sybil mentioned to you that some of the families were upset by this reporting, I say, people, you need to know what's going on. You cannot put your head in the sand.
By the way, how'd that hit you? You're one of those parents who has a child from China. I'm just wondering, was that scary for you too?
You know, you might want to accuse me of putting my head in the sand. But given that I adopted from Jiangsu province, to my knowledge, there are no reports of trafficking that have emerged out of Jiangsu province. Mm-hmm. Plus, I adopted back in 1994. China had been closed for most of the year of 1993 to adoptions from foreigners. So I suspect that my daughter was, quote, and this is a horrible way to put it, legitimately abandoned. Mm. Now, was it a good thing she was abandoned? Heck no. These people were forced either by financial reasons, because they couldn't afford to pay the very steep fine that families are charged if they have a so-called over-quota child, or they just were panic-stricken about someone finding out that they had had a child. Hmm. I mean, it's a horrible decision either way.
Well, do you think that, given the current news of all the trafficking recently, do you think that these parents will go back? And where do you see it playing out?
I think there are two schools of thought. And Sybil mentioned consulting with a lawyer about this. I've got to say, I cannot imagine any scenario where an adoption that was legalized in China and the United States could ever be undone. But based on my conversations with some of the people who work in this adoption field, they're afraid that the parents won't go back to China for fear that if they find something out, someone will take their child back. Mm. That is not going to happen. But I think parents do owe their adopted children from China a trip back to China, and I wish I had the money to take my daughter back every year. My daughter does want to search for her birth family. We strongly suspect, based on research, that she probably has an older biological sister and perhaps even a younger brother back in China. And my feeling about waiting, you know, I'm already 15 years past my adoption year. Parents age, parents die. Hmm. I don't want to lose the trail, which we don't even have anyway.
But that's you. What are your thoughts about parents like Sybil or others who might go back and find that there's a parent who's been desperate to get their child back or her, whose heart is broken?
Well, I think I would feel the same way. You know, if I found out that another mother had to make this sort of sacrifice, I would want to include that woman in my daughter's and my life. And I think there will be ways to do this, and I think at some point the Chinese government might have to soften on this issue. But I would hope that parents could be open enough to their children's concerns and psyches that they would be inclusive on this. Now, how old will children have to be to know what they want? And yes, it should be up to the child to a great extent. Do you want to search for your birth family? Do you want to find out whether you were trafficked? So you've got this sort of dichotomy going. You've got waiting for the child to mature enough, yet wondering what's happening with the birth family back in China. Are they dispersing? Are they dying? Are they ill? So it's a terrible conundrum.
What's happening with adoptions from China with parents in America? Is it slowing down?
Way down, thousands down. And people are starting to look at other countries, but many of them have similar issues. You know, one family I talked to, they're going to Ethiopia for their second child, and Ethiopia has just come out with trafficking stories. And this has happened with Guatemala. This has happened with Vietnam. I talked to an adoption educator named Jane Brown. She says this happens with all sending countries. Corruption intervenes.
Right.
People stand to benefit from it.
Well, one wonders if prospective parents might take a closer look at adoption of children here in the United States.
Well, that's a possibility, and the other side of that coin is that more families in China are being allowed to adopt. In years past, that was frowned on, but that is increasing fairly rapidly. And yes, one could argue that it's better to leave the children in their culture with their language and their food and people who look like them.
That's Martha Groves of the Los Angeles Times, who's done some terrific reporting on revelations of child trafficking in China. But also, as we heard, herself adopted a child from China years ago. Martha, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
The 2009 Los Angeles Auto Show is underway, and as usual, manufacturers from Detroit and abroad are showcasing new models and those wacky concept cars that probably nobody will ever drive. Wait a minute, isn't that what they once said about electric cars? And this year, while balance sheets are in the red, car engineers are going green. Joining us from WDET in Detroit is Paul Eisenstein, publisher of the DetroitBureau.com website. Paul, you were at the press preview. What's your headline from the auto show?
Well, it was a downsized show that you really could get charged up about. Ooh, sorry, that was painful. It was downsized in quite a lot of ways. You saw a lot of small cars at this show, the Ford Fiesta, for example, the Mazda 2, and even some of the trucks were smaller than they used to be. But what was really emphasized was the turn for electrification. The Chevy Volt in production form made its preview at the show. We saw the Fisker Karma, which is another plug-in vehicle, make its production debut. This is an electric auto industry right now.
Well, Jerry Garrett, who, as you well know, writes about cars for the LA Times, said this was a transformational year for the show, that the cars that we'd been teased about for decades were finally coming more into focus. Yet, with all this electricity, the award for green car of the year went to a diesel car, the Audi A3 TDI. Second year in a row went to a diesel. But this isn't your grandfather's diesel?
No, definitely not. Anybody in this country who remembers diesels as being slow, smelly, uncomfortable to drive needs to check again. The diesel of today is a lot of fun to drive.
Well, it's also called a clean diesel.
Right. And that's a big difference because they have been able to bring the current diesel technology in compliance with the toughest emission standards in the country, the California standards, which are being adopted by much of the country now. The people who awarded the Green Car of the Year trophy 2 years in a row now, as you said, told me they were sending a political message with this award, that regulators understand that diesels have to be an important part of the mix of clean technology.
Well, and last year it was the Volkswagen Passat TDI that got the Green Award. And you mentioned sending messages to Washington and standards. Yesterday, we know the EPA made that big announcement about the dangers of carbon emissions, and that sets the stage for them to regulate if Congress won't legislate. What's the buzz about that kind of talk coming from Washington?
Most manufacturers have reluctantly come to accept that consumers are demanding, and regulators, of course, are demanding cleaner automobiles. The challenge is whether or not government will wind up regulating so narrowly that they, first of all, drive up prices, and secondly, they wind up essentially forcing on the market solutions that really aren't solutions. Urban transportation, the electric vehicle, will work very well. Hybrids work for people who spend a lot of time in dense traffic. But if you're trying to, say, tow, or you need larger vehicles and the like, you may need the diesel, or you may need regular gasoline technology, which is going through, surprisingly, a radical transformation. You have makers like Hyundai and Ford saying that they will increase the fuel efficiency of their gasoline vehicles as much as 35% in the next 5 years.
Well, we just want to make sure while we have you that we quickly touch on some of the business aspect of this. This had to be the first year that the keynote speaker couldn't speak because he was fired or quit hours before. This is, of course, GM's CEO, Fritz Henderson. What's the buzz at the show about GM?
Well, everybody was talking about GM, and the question is, what exactly is happening there? Who's going to be running the company? Will Ed Whitaker, the former AT&T chairman, who is now the chairman of the board, decide not to just be temporary or acting CEO at GM, but will he want to keep that job indefinitely. It's a definite shakeup, and the one question that everybody is asking is whether GM will be so shaken up that the company is paralyzed by turmoil at a time when it needs to really focus more than ever. The good thing was they showed some interesting vehicles in L.A., not just the Volt, but some traditional cars like the Cadillac CTS Coupe, that are really saying GM can make a dent in the market, can make a comeback.
That's Paul Eisenstein, publisher of the DetroitBureau.com, the car news website, with all the latest news from the L.A. Car Show, which runs through December 13th. Paul, thanks as always.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be with you.
Okay, up next, Iranians living outside their country say their government is tracking them down through social network sites. We'll have that story in about 30 seconds, here and now. In Iran, the Green Movement, born after the disputed June 12th presidential elections, appears to be resurrecting. Today, several thousand students protested at Tehran University. Yesterday, tens of thousands of students and ordinary Iranians took to the streets across the country. For the first time, many calling for the separation of religion and politics and carrying Iranian flags without the national symbol of Allah, symbols that were put on the flag after the 1979 revolution. Yesterday, people were beaten back and arrested. Today, Iran's top prosecutor said the government has shown restraint, but from now on, no leniency will be applied. Since June, five activists have been sentenced to death, 80 others sent to prison. And our next guest says the hardline Islamic government is also now threatening Iranians abroad. Farnaz Fasihi reports on Iran for the Wall Street Journal. She joins us from Beirut, Lebanon. Farnaz, Iranians abroad being targeted. How so? By whom?
Well, what our research and investigation showed was that many normal, ordinary Iranians who had suddenly found themselves politically active, and by saying politically active, I don't mean that they're famous activists or they're dissident figures. I mean that they go to protests organized in cities across the globe in support of the Green Movement in Iran, or they post critical comments about the Iranian regime's handling of the election on Facebook, on Twitter. Many people say that they've received threatening emails by anonymous people, that their families in Iran have received threatening phone calls and intimidation saying, tell your so-and-so with a specific name that they should end their activities against the Iranian regime. And several people we interviewed said that when they went back to Iran this summer, they were stopped at the airport, their passports taken from them, and one person we talked to was actually arrested.
Is this the Iranian that you spoke to who now lives in a German-speaking part of Europe?
Right. For security reasons, this person asked us not to identify the country where he lived or his full name.
Right. And what did he say happened to him when he traveled back to Tehran?
He said that when he went back to Iran, he was stopped at the international airport in Tehran. His laptop, his European cell phone, and the calendar, the file of facts that he carried was taken away from him. A couple of days later, security agents went to his parents' home in Tehran. He was visiting his father, who was sick, and arrested him and kept him blindfolded at a detention center, beat him, kicked him, charged him with participating in anti-regime protests abroad, leaving comments on opposition websites, and more importantly, showed him pictures of himself and his friends at a rally in the summer in a European capital in support of the Green Movement, and they asked him to identify people and asked him if he wants to get his passport and leave the country, he must act as an informant.
And he did ultimately leave the country. What did he have to do?
He had to sign the paper saying he was guilty of all the charges and that he promised never to attend any more opposition rallies against Iran's government, and that he agreed to cooperate and send information as they asked. And I think the more important message that this has sent is that, you know, word travels in the Iranian community. This person has told his friends, has told his friends have told friends, and people are starting to panic.
Well, Iran's UN representative to the U.S. Denied to you that the government is threatening Iranians abroad. But on the other hand, you report that Iran's deputy commander of the armed forces wrote an editorial in a conservative newspaper that protesters inside and outside Iran have been identified and will be dealt with. And you also report that the German government looked into these allegations of Iranians living outside of the country. What did Germany find?
Germany found that there were Iranian agents filming and taking pictures of protesters, of opposition protesters, and they were gathering information on them. And the German government also told us that the Iranian government had asked them to ban anti-Iranian protests in Germany.
Well, you have other examples of Iranians living outside of Iran saying that they've been targeted and threatened, and mainly through these social networking sites. Tell us about the story of Kusha. What does he say?
Kusha had created a petition for a human rights activist in Iran who was arrested after the election, and he received a threatening email one day from an anonymous source saying that his family would face trouble if he didn't end his criticism of the Iranian government. And, you know, as I said in my story, he thought this was just a joke, this was bogus, and, you know, he lives in the U.S., he's American. And then 2 days later, his mother told him that security agents had come to their house and arrested his father and told him to tell his son to bring down the petition. And the interesting thing here is that it's the flip side of the Internet. You know, on one hand, the Internet is opening up the world to the Iranian protesters. But on the other hand, it's also being used by the regime as a tool to monitor people, to find out what they're thinking, to find out where they're going, what they're planning, and to use it against them. And the Iranian regime has made no secret that it's doing this. It publicly announced that it's creating an Internet crime unit, that it's training Internet lieutenants who are going to be policing all the websites and social networking websites that carry criticism of the regime.
Well, we spoke to Kelly Nignajad, who runs the Tehran Bureau website here in the Massachusetts area, and she said she hasn't heard anecdotally about anyone who's, you know, been contacted through their Facebook and they believe that it's an Iranian official. But she says she and others who are writing for this protest website, you know, aggregating information from around the world, assume that that's possible. So they're very careful. I guess my question to you, Farnaz, is this new? Because some Americans might assume, well, of course, this is, you know, Iran post-1979. Of course they're tracking Iranians abroad. Is it new?
The new factor about this is that they're going after low-profile, ordinary people. You know, Iran has actually had a very interesting relationship with its diaspora. It hasn't really tried to disown them. I mean, you know, the interesting thing is that every year when the president comes to the UN General Assembly, they throw a very large, lavish party. They invite all the Iranians who live in the tri-state area to New York to a very nice dinner. They encourage them to go back and invest in Iran, to go back and visit family. So in that sense, Iran has sort of since 1979 enjoyed actually a pretty good relationship with its diaspora. And this turn of events is new. And the diaspora hasn't really been very active. I mean, it wasn't like the Cuban expats in Florida. You know, like the Iranians weren't really political, weren't really anti-regime. They didn't really participate in a lot of protests. It wasn't mainstream the way that it is now.
That's Farnaz Fasihi reporting on what many Iranians living outside of their homeland say is an attempt by officials in Iran to track them down through social networking sites like Facebook and Twitter. Farnaz writes for The Wall Street Journal from Beirut, Lebanon. Farnaz, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Robin. Pleasure.
Okay, looking ahead, we're going to take about a minute break and then have an amazing story about origami. And you can go to our website, hereandnow.org, to get a jump start, see some really extraordinary pictures. How do they do that? Back in about 1 minute, hereandnow.org. Welcome back to Here and Now.
People are starting to use mathematical terminology to describe paper.
Computer algorithms.
Algorithms.
Ideal proportion.
Reverse folds.
Complex.
More complex.
Very, very complex.
Insanely complex.
Those are MIT students at a paper folding competition, and it is insanely, insanely complex. The premise of paper folding or origami is simple. Take a piece of paper and transform it without using scissors, tape, or glue. No cuts allowed. But how intense can it get? Well, here's artist Chris Palmer. He spent over 4 hours making one piece. First, it's a huge fan, then it's a chef's hat, now it's a flower.
Doing a little fine work there. That came out pretty good.
Chris Palmer is one of several internationally renowned artists and engineers featured along with MIT students in the new documentary Between the Folds, which begins airing tonight on PBS stations around the country. It's an astonishing look at the world of folding paper, the sheer beauty, but also the science. Did you know that airbags are based on origami algorithm? Airbags fold up before they open, and researchers are working on how to fold proteins to fight disease. Michael LaFosse is one of the artists featured in the film. His studio is called Origamido. He's based in Haverhill, Massachusetts, but he's in the process of moving to Hawaii and stops in our studio on the way. Michael, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Robin.
I have to say, this is mind-blowing. It's the kind of thing we're trying to get across on radio, but we'll also have pictures at our website, hereandnow.org. Mm-hmm. But I'm looking at some of your pieces. Here, for instance, is a kind of impressionist pig. This is one piece of paper originally, right?
Yes, that's Wilbur, and that's from a 15-inch square of my handmade paper. About 3 hours total folding time, but about a month to conceive the project, design it, make the custom paper for it, and finally fold it.
That's because you're one of the few origami artists who also, with your partner Richard Alexander, makes your own paper. What's the importance of the paper? What's the best origami paper?
Well, every different origami really deserves its own best fit. And part of the challenge of creating a new design and actually folding one, even if you don't invent your own, is to find the right paper. And it can take a few minutes, it can take years. For example, if you're going to fold a classic origami crane, basic paper will do because you want crisp, clean lines. But if you want something like Wilbur, you want something that's more soft and shapeable, and so you'll want a thicker paper.
How did you get into this?
As a little boy, of course, like so many others, we learned how to make paper airplanes. But when I was 13 years old, this magazine came to our house. We subscribed to Reader's Digest back then. I actually even have the Reader's Digest article pages with me. And look at the face he did of his self-portrait in origami.
The now late master of origami.
Yes, Akira Yoshizawa from Tokyo.
It's amazing. Yeah. It's got the paper. It's a brown piece of paper, and it's folded where there's a brow and folded where there's eyes.
Yes.
And he's folded a nose and a mouth. And it's stunning. It looks just like him.
Well, you know, I also wanted to be an artist, and here was the clear touch of an artist in this work.
You've got some paper here.
Yes.
Can you make something for us, something simple? So
yes.
That
I will fold an example of Master Yoshizawa's simple butterfly.
Okay.
Yeah.
You've got a small square of yellow paper.
Yes, and this is the classic origami paper that you can buy. It's about 15 centimeters square, color on one side, white on the other.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to put in some simple folds. I'm folding in half, edge to edge. And in origami, we unfold. You see that I had unfolded the paper.
Right. And now you're folding it the other way?
Yes, edge to edge the other way. I have to put in folds on the other side of the paper, so I've flipped it over. And the reason is that folds bend one way.
Now you're folding it in a triangle like a dinner napkin.
And you see how the color is on the outside. To be able to put multiple direction folds, you have to flip the paper. And that's the way you make a paper fan. You turn it over and you put in a fold, you turn it over. And you can see this fan shape that's happened, creating a four-pointed star, each of the corners of the square.
Right. Now it's triangles.
The triangles.
Yep.
These flaps, which are corners of the square, are now free to move. I didn't need to use scissors or cuts to do that. You can see here, and I'm going to reorganize the layers just a little bit more.
Now it's looking like a little kid's sailor hat.
Doesn't it look like that? Or, you know, the little boats that Curious George
right.
made
That's
with his newspapers on his route. But then here's a surprise. And people often will see this shape and think that I have actually cut the paper. But you can look at the development.
It looks like you've cut these little triangles out.
Yeah.
But you haven't.
There's never been a rule saying that you can't cut the paper in origami. There's a desire not to cut. And in fact, now we don't need to cut. We've spent time engineering the possibilities. That's what's taken us the last 80 years.
Because we see that. And in fact, we want to talk about what engineers are doing. But, oh, it's a butterfly. It's a butterfly.
Yeah, and that I love this symbol.
How did you do that?
I did it very well, thank you.
Yes, you did.
Actually, the thing that I like to tell people is that origami is a metamorphic art form, and that's one of its great charms. You do not remove anything from the paper. You do not add anything. You change its shape by folding only.
Right.
And the butterfly is a wonderful symbol of metamorphosis for the art of origami. And this is Yoshizawa's famous swallowtail butterfly.
And a reminder, you can see a picture at our website, hereandnow.org. But Michael, you mentioned engineering and math problems. We see both in the film. Engineers who say at heart origami is an engineering problem. You know, how do I get paper to do what I want? And mathematicians who use it to demonstrate math problems to students. And scientists like MIT's Eric Demain, he uses origami to understand how proteins fold so that he can make drugs that will attack diseases like AIDS. Are you surprised at how much origami is touching us?
I'm not surprised, but I'm very grateful that so many wonderful minds and talents have come to our art to share the technology that we pioneers of the art have been developing over the past decades. So it's getting out there and people are grabbing it and they're using it.
Do you think it's also a place for, this odd, maybe an odd question, for people who have, it's a healthy place to put obsession. It's obsessive to get the little, to work on things for hours and hours and hours.
You know, one of the most common comments I get is, you must have a lot of patience. Actually, I don't. But you will find all the time in the world to do something that you love to do. A musician needs to be obsessed with the details as well as an origami artist. Those obsessions of detail will make the difference in whether something is truly useful, beautiful, functional, or worthwhile.
Also, there's a lot of learning along the way. There's a lot of it that's just trying things. But you and others talk about how that's okay because eventually that might become art, and comparing it to Chopin's etudes, which started as finger exercises, but now we play them as pieces.
Yes. You know, if someone is used to seeing the origami crane with its geometric efficiency, but then they look at Wilbur, which has these curved creases, they don't quite believe that they're looking at origami. They're trying to pigeonhole it, but if they are truly interested in the art of origami, it's as expansive as music. How can you say that one kind of music is music and another kind isn't? And when other people look at our works, we hope that they get what it is we're trying to do.
Somebody is obviously already getting it. Do I understand you have a piece in the Louvre?
Oh, it was on display at the Louvre, and he's here. That's Wilbur.
That's Wilbur?
Yes. That Wilbur. Was back in 1998, I believe. And
how are you going to keep him down on the farm?
I know. He's he's some pig. He's been in more places around the world than I have. But one of the reasons why we make our own paper is we want it to be archival and permanent, that the colors won't fade, because we think that these artifacts need to survive us and inspire the future. We hope that more people who are going to collect origami also look for pieces that are made out of good quality materials.
Well, I guess you're saying the hope is that Wilbur goes to the Louvre and stays.
And stays.
Michael Lafosse of Origami Do Studios, one of several artists featured in the new documentary Between the Folds. For more, go to our website, hereandnow.org, where you can see pictures and videos of Michael's work. Michael, thanks so much.
My pleasure.